Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, Chef John Besh and I head into the Southern Food and Beverage Museum's kitchen, located just outside our studio doors, to cook up an amazing oyster stew from his newly released book, Besh Big Easy. John's concerned that some of his favorite old-fashioned dishes are disappearing from Louisiana dinner tables, and he intends to inspire people to bring them back with recipes in his new book. Lots of that Louisiana one-pot cooking is done in cast iron, which requires a bit of know-how. So next, we travel to the annual Black Pot Festival in Lafayette, Louisiana, to learn from some of the best. And food writer Stanley Dry joins us to reflect on what makes Louisiana cooking so unique. Get out your grandmother's cast iron. We're getting ready to stir the pots on this week's Louisiana Eats. If there's one thing that brings people together, it's good old homestyle New Orleans cooking. That's why I persuaded Chef John Besh to join me in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum kitchen to show us the secrets of his old-fashioned oyster stew and give us a taste of his new book, Besh Big Easy.
And so these are some of the recipes that I really do want to highlight because, one, it's easy. It's kind of, you know, it's very soul-warming. And I just want to walk you through it. So
okay,
to begin
go.
With, pan on kind of like moderate heat. I want to barely cover the pan, the bottom of the pan, with just a little bit of olive oil.
Okay.
I used to go out, you know, the restaurant August, that's our flagship. It was named August after August Robin. Or they would say down in the parish, August Robin. And August, otherwise known as Duke Robin, he was this gregarious hunter, fisherman, businessman, politician from Wycloski.
Wycloski.
And his family, they were trappers, and they shrimped, and they had oyster beds. And just like many other great recipes of New Orleans, they would take all these different influences, whether it was the Italians and the Croatians with their use of olive oil. And so this is nothing but onion, garlic, some tomatoes, smothering down, and just a little bit of olive oil.
It smells delicious.
And now, this surprises me.
I have to remark that I've never had an oyster stew
with
tomatoes.
Right, before. And that's why I love this recipe, because this was something very unique to Duke. And we would go out once a year, just for fun, harvest oysters with his family. And on the boat, we would cook oysters every which way known to mankind. And this was always the one place that they loved, you know, like the one style that was like all the old timers' favorite. Smothered down. And so I just want to keep cooking these kind of over medium low heat. I want those tomatoes just to soften up. And again, whenever you can, you want to throw those Creole tomatoes. And, you know, these come from the Lyuza family down in St. Bernard. And it's about like, this is kind of like real and like down the parish cooking.
I have a question for you for a home cook, because watching what you're doing, it would be my guess that your biggest danger in this process would be cooking it at too high of a heat and browning the garlic.
Yeah, kind of like if you brown the garlic, then it's going to get bitter.
Right.
And so, also one thing that I didn't mention, at this point in the process, I love to throw in a couple pinches of cayenne pepper or red pepper flakes, same thing. I like to throw it into the oil and let that oil just toast that pepper just a little bit.
I
and then I've even added a pinch of thyme.
This is one of my favorite visuals because in the pan right now, the food's literally doing, it's like the reason that we call it saute, because it means
because
to jump.
It's jumping, right.
Yeah, and it's you just look at it, dancing a little bit in the pan.
And so what I love, and I try to tell the young cooks, is that I want you to cook with all of your senses. Can you hear that pan? That sound right there just tells you everything you need to know. So you need to smell it. You need to watch it. You need to listen. And as you're doing that, give it, you know, you want to stir it occasionally to make sure you don't develop those hot spots. Now I am using this
exquisite
my
copper.
Mama's big old copper pan. And these are what these things are really, they want to be cooked in. I have two pans that I use. I have my big cast iron pots that never leave the stovetop because they're too darn heavy to put away. And
right.
So I leave them out. And then I have a couple big copper pots like this. When you're cooking for a small army like I am, you're cooking big food. You're cooking a lot of food. And so a lot of these recipes in Besh Big Easy really come down to feeding six or more people. I've just added about an inch of oyster liquor to the pan. And then I'm gonna add equal parts vermouth and some of that beautiful cream from the Moté family.
Oh my, there's nothing like the cream from the Moté family.
And so basically the recipe is one part cream, one part vermouth, two parts oyster liquor. I don't know why we call things liquor. I don't know why we call things dressings when they're really stuffings. But, you know, it's in our vernacular where this is what it is. And so the oyster juice that comes from the oyster, when you shuck those oysters, you want to save that juice. And that juice is then going to be saved for your gumbos and your dressings. And you can't make an oyster dressing without a little oyster liquor in there.
No.
And so that juice that gathers in the oyster is so full of flavor. And I hate the word. It's so overused, but that umami flavor, there's something it's just soulful about it, that when I taste an oyster, it's not just salty, it's just not a little sweet, it's just not spicy from whatever the Tabasco that we douse over it, but it has this this other dimension to it, and that we call umami, and adding that just kind of brings out a lot of flavors. I find that if I add a little bit of oyster liquor, and the Chinese have known this forever in their XO sauces, and the Koreans have known this forever. They use oyster liquor in their a lot of kimchis. Kimchi has oysters in it. That helps with the fermentation. It's used as a bacterial starter or the fermenting process. And so,
well, this is exciting. We're at like a big, big, big boil. I would be nervous about boiling something with that heavy cream in it. Usually people in their recipies and such say, add the heavy cream, so what's your thoughts on this, and how come we can have this at this beautiful rolling boil?
Well, what I want to do is just allow that to reduce together. I'm adding a few dashes of Tabasco, and I added a squeeze of lemon juice too. And it's just about there. I want it to coat the back of a spoon. Now, back in the olden days, people might not have, you know, they wouldn't be hard to find maybe some cream, and people just simmer it down with milk. And that's when you're going to have it curdle and break just a little bit, but the flavor is still there. And if you can get past that, then you're doing okay. So half and half is going to work a little better than milk would. And now I want to just turn it down to as low as it can go.
How do you judge when the oyster is done?
I'm looking at this oyster, and I just want the edges to seize up. You see how it's seizing up right there?
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to plump it up when they do that. And that tells me that they're absolutely perfect.
Oh, gosh. Of course, people can go to the website and not only find the recipe for this from your book, but they'll also be able to see what this delicious dish looks like. One of the things that is really beautiful, John, is the color.
You know, just a few tomatoes. This is just, yeah, some crushed tomatoes. A handful of them have made a huge difference in coloring that broth. And so the broth is more of like a salmon color.
Mm-hmm.
It's not red, but it's also not the traditional white broth mm-hmm. that you would see everywhere. And so this is a combination of the French and the Isleños and the Italians and the Croatians coming together in Wacloski in southern St. Bernard. And that's truly what does bring us all together in southeast Louisiana, is that food. Black, white, red, yellow, we all love our gumbo. We all love the etouffees, and we all love oyster stew.
So, John, this book, is it arranged in a conventional sort of appetizer to dessert?
And which it, I've never done before. Easy apps, and that's what it really comes down to. Things that I cook at home when I don't have a lot of time, because I'm generally not at home prepping hours or days, for that matter, on end to have guests over. So I've got crab meat. I can make crab meat ravigote. Other people, no matter, you know, whichever family you come from, you might call it crab salad, you might call it crab maison. When I was a kid, every little joint in town, including Time Savers, had stuffed artichokes. They were doused in olive oil and Parmesan and Italian breadcrumbs and wrapped in cellophane for you to just to take home and pop into the oven. And so kind of everybody knew how to eat these things. And I find that we're kind of losing that part of
our
culture.
I don't know a lot of people who know how to make a stuffed artichoke. That is a great recipe.
And so then we also have one chapter just on gumbos, and then a chapter on veggies, like New Orleans-style veggies, where we're stuffing tomatoes, and we're frying eggplant, we're creaming turnips, and we're grilling okra.
Well, John, it's a beautiful book. It's a delicious oyster stew. And as always, I'm thrilled and honored to have you here with me. And I hope all of the Louisiana Eats listeners will rush out and get a copy of, I think, your most approachable book yet.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, John. Chef John Besh and his new book, Besh Big Easy.
Well, down in New Orleans, they're doing the facts, and they got a new dance called Popeye.
When we come back, we're heading to Lafayette for the annual Black Pot Festival, so stay tuned. We're going to his.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's.
I'm going down to Lafayette. I don't care how long I'm gone. It's so hard to leave you, Lafayette.
Chefs from across South Louisiana gather annually in Lafayette's Acadian Village for the Black Pot Cook-Off. The village looks a bit like a 19th century Cajun frontier, complete with bayou and shady oak trees. Booths rim the perimeter of the fairgrounds, where each contestant prepares to compete with their very own Black Pot. Here's Ryan Trahan of Dark Roo.
Most people's pots are just as important to them as, I guess, say their wives are. Some of them really, really get married to their pots. And Big Lou that we were talking with the other night, he's had pots for 30 years and he loves them, and he has pots that he uses for one specific thing only. And it's just all a matter of personal preference.
There are five categories in the competition: cracklin, jambalaya, gumbo, dessert, and gravy, which includes any kind of sauce like sauce piquante. Ryan and his restaurant partner, Corey Bourgeois, have done their fair share of festival cooking, but this is their first foray into the Black Pot competition.
We borrowed this Black Pot from Curtis Louvier, who's very, very knowledgeable and has been doing this for years. And so I went over my game plan with him last night, and he was very, very helpful with just little tips here and there. And that's what I love about, like, the community we have, like, say, like, just being able to ask each other for advice. I ask Jeremy all the time. He's been doing this longer than I have. People like that are really good to be friends with, because they, those weird little things that you ask questions about, they've probably done or not done.
Their good friend Jeremy Connor is a 6 foot something beast of a man positioned just to the right of the dark roux guys. His dish, a chicken and sausage gumbo.
This is one of the most fun parts of making a gumbo is when the roux is almost dark enough and you just get to smell it and play with it. This is the best part. Well, when you're cooking for a lot of people, this is the best way to make gumbo. When we make gumbo at the restaurant, we use aluminum and stainless steel cookware, but you know, in a situation like this where you want to prepare a large sort of rustic meal for a whole lot of people at once, this is the way to go, and you don't get these kind of results with any other way to cook.
That connection to black pots runs deep, real deep. John Vidrine, a seasoned veteran of black pot, remembers his grandmother's kitchen being an arsenal of black pots, with one pot for every special dish.
Black pots in our family are the treasures that we pass on. My son is going to inherit my pots. I inherited a couple of them, and in fact, I can remember it's like when she, you know, I hated to see her pass, but you know, I can remember the family getting together and say, "So which pot do you want?" I want the sauce pot, you know, or I want the fry pot. And so I got the sauce pot.
Competitors pay a minimum $50 entrance fee and compete for a $150 cash prize. Even in a winning scenario, there's no way that the $100 spread could recoup their expense. There's a lot of lagniappe to be found on the fairgrounds. J.D. Regard has beignets and old fashions free for the taking.
In the bar alone, I've got about $450 invested today. And we have a lot of people coming to Black Pot from all parts of the country. New York, just today, New York, Vermont, Wisconsin, Germany, France. It's amazing. And we love sharing. We brought lots of booze. Lots of food. The folks that are giving it away don't get paid for this. You know, we're out here giving it away. But that's what makes this particular festival, I think, one of the most unique festivals in the state of Louisiana.
Meanwhile, Jeremy Connor and the Dark Roux guys are still stirring the pots. Ryan's working on a backbone stew, while Corey patiently stirs that roux. They've got another kind of crazy dish in mind.
I think our dessert is going to be the one that catches most people's eyes. With Ryan made a chocolate ganache-filled donut that we're going to fry in our crackling grease, and then we're going to make a vanilla bean ice cream with our liquid nitrogen. The only rule is it has to be cooked in a black pot, so we're going to follow that.
Back at the Dark Roux booth, they're feeling the pressure of the clock, but are keeping a cool head on their shoulders.
It's coming along very well. We had to kind of cut our roux time down and not get it as dark as we wanted because we were running out of time. But I'm really happy with everything right now. They're about to start getting frying chicken over there ready. We're going to top each bowl of gumbo with some fried chicken.
Before long, the birds are ready, and dinner is served.
Come on down, folks! Gumbo and fried chicken! Woo!
But the crew has one more trick up their sleeve.
Wait, you forgot about the ice cream, man!
I'm gonna go slower on this one. Too fast. You're burning me.
I have no idea how they pull this one off.
Let's go, chef!
Using traditional ingredients, a black pot, liquid nitrogen, and a huge hand blender that they lift over their shoulders, the guys at Dark Roux are drawing a huge crowd of spectators.
Now, you see all the air we got in this one?
Yep, I see you. I got you.
That's gonna be good. That's gonna be good. All right, who wants to lick it?
Pick me!
As the food rolls out, the attendees are satiated, and the twinkle of twilight begins to set in. There's only one thing left to do.
I feel like shots are in order now.
Let's do it.
Shots are in order.
Let's do it. Successful.
All right. Who wants some?
The winners are announced, and Jeremy Connor is in that number. Everybody packs the dance floor, and now the real party is on. That's the Black Pot Festival Experience in Lafayette's Acadiana Village. My friend Boo McComber is the genuine article. This Abbeville native has spent her life steeped in Cajun culture, and like many in Southwest Louisiana, Boo's number one talent is black pot cooking. Oh my, the delicious things I've tasted that come from Boo's old cast iron pots. My favorite, her dirty rice. You may have eaten dirty rice before, but trust me, you've never lived until you've had Boo's version. Dirty rice gets its name from dark bits of meat that are cooked with the rice, turning it all a dirty brown. When Boo makes her dirty rice, she starts off by making a roux. Okay, call me a city girl, but hers is the only dirty rice recipe I've ever seen that starts that way. In her black iron Dutch oven, Boo stirs together oil and flour until it's a dark chocolate brown, and then the onions are added, followed by celery and bell pepper. Meanwhile, in a separate skillet, she browns ground beef and sliced andouille sausage. I've never seen andouille in dirty rice before. Have you? When the meats are browned, she adds them to the roux and the seasonings with enough beef broth to make a thin gravy. She seasons the pot with bay leaves, garlic, parsley, green onions, and Worcestershire sauce. Then she simmers it for at least an hour, adding more broth if need be. Boo cooks her rice separately. Another odd variation, because usually the rice would cook with the meats and broth in order to absorb those flavors. But trust me, follow Boo's instructions, because when the rice is combined with that flavorful meat dressing, you've got something so good. Well, sometimes I could eat it till I'm sick. For a copy of Boo's recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com or at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Boo McComber's dirty rice is some good Louisiana Eats. Black pot cooking is one of many Cajun culinary traditions. Another is the boucherie, an event where families gather for a communal pig slaughter, using almost every part of the pig to craft a variety of delicious dishes. The Southern Food and Beverage Museum hosted Luke DeVille of Teats Food Store from Ville Platte, Louisiana, for a demonstration on how to prepare Cajun classics like boudin, hogshead cheese, and ponce. Producer Sean Johnson was in attendance that afternoon and sent us this postcard.
Traditionally, a smoked ponce used to be a special occasion type dish, like Christmas, Thanksgiving, things like that. Now it's become so popular, a lot of people eat it on Sunday dinners with their families. Traditionally, you'll serve it with rice, and you'll make a gravy with the onions, bell peppers, celery, the Trinity. It really makes a really, really good gravy. There's also another type of ponce in the Lafayette area. It's called Chaudin. It's unsmoked. It's just your regular pig stomach stuffed with pork, onions, green onions, and parsley. Some other people put different other things, but it's simple the way we do it. If you do a smoked ponce and a unsmoked ponce together, brown it up real good, boil it for about an hour and a half, get the skin tender. It really makes a really good gravy. The other thing here we have, the other one, is the regular smoked pork ponce. That's our best seller. Then you have the jalapeno cheese ponce behind it. That's by far the best. If you ever cook one, you can start off by poking three or four holes in it with a kitchen fork. Put about an inch of water in your pot and you can boil it. Or you can stick it in the oven at about 350. You can bake it for about an hour, hour and a half, remove it, and then you can brown onions and bell peppers. And we smoke on average, what we make during the winter times when we sell the most for gumbos, we sell the most sausage. We can make anywhere between 2,500 pounds to 4,000 pounds just pork sausage a week. And now Bill Platt is 12,000 people.
My name is Dixie Poche. I'm from Cecilia, near Breaux Bridge in St. Martin Parish. Breaux Bridge is known as Cajun capital of the world. I graduated from then USL in journalism. I always had a love for writing and always loved history. So this book I've written is a local history book. It's called Classic Eateries of Cajun Country, just released by Arcadia Publishing. And in it, I took a nostalgic look at 40 French Louisiana old-time restaurants, bakeries, and grocery stores. I did it as a way to pay homage to the many mom-and-pop shops that faced a lot of challenges and still survived. Personally, I was inspired by my aunt and uncle's grocery store in Cecilia, where I was growing up. There were six similar grocery stores within a mile radius, but each one had its own little specialty, and my aunts had plate lunches on Sundays with pork roast and rice dressing and fried chicken and meatballs, which we called boulettes. She was also well known for the boudin that they prepared, with the regular boudin and also the boudin rouge, which is blood boudin. She learned how to make boudin from the Yuval family boucheries that were held in the country, which was common. They'd get groups of families together and they do a bouchery is a pig slaughtering. It would take all day, and this was the days before refrigeration, where you had to use every part of the pig, everything but the squeal, they say. So it's really from the pig snout all the way to the feet. And it was from these recipes that my aunt learned how to make boudin, which inspired me. So as a follow-through on kind of tied into my book, I wanted to do a food demo and tie it into the boucheries, because that is a Louisiana tradition. So I requested some help from one of the grocery stores that's featured in the book, and it's Teets, T-E-E-T, apostrophe S, Market in Ville Platte. I was really intrigued when I visited the store for the first time. There was a sign in French, and it said that they specialize in la viande de boucanet, which means smoked meats. Ville Platte is known for their smoked meats in that area. And at Teets, it's an old-time grocery store, but they'll have everything. They'll have the boudin, the hogshead cheese. They even have the pigtails, which can be used instead of salt pork to cook beans. And this is just one of the businesses that was featured in the food demo. We also had French bread and ginger cakes from Lejeune's Bakery. This store was started in the late 1800s in Generette in Iberia Parish. And they still make their French bread by hand in the original building. This is a small town, but when you're riding through and you see the red light turning in front of the bakery, you know that the French bread is hot, and it's time to stop for some French bread.
How do you properly care for that black iron cookware? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How do you care for that black iron cookware? The very first thing you must do is season it. Coat the piece all over with vegetable oil and bake it for an hour in a 350-degree oven. Now, the cooking can begin. The more you cook in a piece of cast iron, the better seasoned it will be. That's why Grandma's cast iron is such a treasured heirloom. When it's time to clean it, never soak it. Best to run hot water in the pan immediately, and anything that burned on, scrub with kosher salt or a non-metal brush. If you have to, occasionally use a few drops of mild liquid detergent. If the residue gets to be too sticky, or if it begins to rust, scrub it good with a wire brush and re-season just like before. Cooking in cast iron is even good for your health. The food absorbs some of the iron during the cooking process. The longer you simmer, the more beneficial iron you gain. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Journalist, public radio contributor, and author of Louisiana Rambles, Ian McNulty is always hunting down a new, obscure, but delicious spot for rambling. Ian, where are we rambling to today?
Well, Poppy, today we're taking a little trip to Lafayette to check out a place I just discovered recently, but has quickly grown near and dear to my heart and, more importantly, to my belly.
Oh, yes, and what is that?
Okay, this place is called Johnson's Boucanière. Now, boucanière, some people out there already know, I'm sure, is the Acadian word for smokehouse. And that is exactly what it is. This is basically Johnson's Smokehouse. And it's a traditional butcher shop smokehouse in Lafayette, working with these Cajun traditions. But it has a really interesting backstory to it. It's a fairly new place. It opened in 2008. But like a lot of interesting good things in Louisiana, its roots really go back a bit.
Really? How far?
So back to 1937, when a place called Johnson's Grocery opened up in Eunice, a great town for Cajun music, Cajun culture.
And Cajun meat.
And Cajun meat, absolutely. Well, Johnson's Grocery was a little dry goods place when it first opened, but it evolved over the generations into like one of the real go-to places in the Cajun prairie for boudin, of course, our favorite rice and pork sausage there in the links. You know, the Cajun breakfast, the Cajun lunch, the Cajun dinner, the Cajun snack, the Cajun everything, boudin. Well, sadly, to a lot of people, Johnson's Grocery closed in 2005 after, you know, a really long run of decades and decades and decades. But a few years later, another generation of the family just got the itch to get back into the business and really to reignite these old family recipes that were so popular there for so long. And they opened Johnson's Boucanière. Now, this is in Lafayette. It's not in Eunice. But if you were familiar with Johnson's Grocery's boudin and you taste what they're doing now at Johnson's Boucanière, same thing. It's same recipe, that same just really good snap to the link and just meaty links of boudin. They're peppery, but really more about savory seasoning than like spicy, spicy hot boudin. Really, to me, like one of the best links of boudin out there.
And what else do you get there besides boudin?
Well, this is a great place. I mean, the boucanière part, of course, the smokehouse, can mean a lot of different things in Cajun country. Here, in addition to boudin, it's really about barbecue, you know.
Barbecue?
This, yeah, it really functions as a Cajun barbecue restaurant. So you got a lot of smoked sausage there, of course, tasso, but also ribs and pork roasts and brisket, all just, you know, done with a little more spice and zing. Now, when you find this place, and I should say it's just on the edge of downtown Lafayette, just outside of the business district there, and not too far from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, it looks from the outside like a little grocery store, you know, and it's kind of packed inside with all sorts of clutter and stuff and little signs to read everywhere. And you can go in and get a pound of this or a pound of that. You can also eat in, and they have all kinds of sandwiches and plate lunches. And everyone eats kind of outside on this kind of wraparound patio deck that really kind of looks like more modern and contemporary. So it's sort of this interesting mashup of the old and the new at this place. And they're also, in addition to their food, they're really about music. They're really into promoting local music. You'll see CDs from local Cajun and Zydeco artists all over the walls, and that Lafayette roots music that's really coming back so strong. And you'll probably see a few musicians that you might recognize from the local festival circuit chowing down there as well.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So what are they eating, you know, besides the boudin? They have things like the Parrain Special, which is basically their idea of a Cajun grilled cheese with a fried boudin ball smashed, covered in barbecue sauce, American cheese, all on an Evangeline-made bun. Evangeline-made being the kind of the big, like almost the big nostalgic kind of bread brand out there. And just really interesting sort of combinations of like smoked pulled chicken covered with smoked garlic pork sausage. I mean, just all these things all together on buns and on plates. The taste is really fabulous. Now, I'll mention it's mostly a lunch place, mostly about lunch or to pick up a feed to bring home, or in the case of our travelers out there, for the cooler, for something to bring back home to wherever you're traveling to. And they do close early on most nights, 6 o'clock, but it'll stay open a little bit later on the weekends if you're going to make a fun weekend of it out there in Lafayette.
Can you buy like a whole chicken? Or?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. When you go in, you'll see some people who are just there for lunch and others who are obviously stocking up for a big feed at home. So really what we have here, Johnson's Boucanière, it's a modern reengineering of a really old traditional Cajun country smokehouse with a long tradition to it. You see this in a lot of places, you know, and a lot all over the country, really. It's a trend. But when it happens in South Louisiana, it's going to be really fun and delicious.
Well, you have made me some hungry. Let's go.
Okay. I'm right behind you.
Okay. You ready to ramble?
Yeah, let's ramble on.
Thank you, Ian. Louisiana Eats ramblin' reporter Ian McNulty. As a writer for Food & Wine magazine, a contributor to the Southern Foodways Alliance, and a lover of Louisiana cooking, it seems natural that Stanley Dry's recent book would be the essential Louisiana cookbook. We all know Louisiana's culinary identity is a complex tapestry of French, Spanish, African, and Native American cultures. But Stanley's collection of recipes not only honors that diversity, it investigates the stories behind the dishes. The Essential Louisiana Cookbook features traditional recipes like crawfish etouffee, sauce piquante, and red beans and rice. But when Stanley sat down to speak with us, his appetite was focused on roux, rice, and gumbo.
Well, roux is so important to Louisiana cooking, and it sounds like a fairly simple thing because it's just flour that's cooked in oil. And certainly it has its roots in French cooking, where roux is used in so many dishes. But to make it without burning it is a whole other thing. I certainly burned my share, and if you take your eye off it for an instant, you can burn it. Or if you let it go a little too far, you can burn it. And then you throw the whole thing out because there's no resurrecting a burned roux.
There's nothing as tragic as if you've used that precious oil. If you've written the Essential Louisiana Cookbook, what is the most essential thing in Louisiana cooking?
Well, a roux would be right up there at the top, wouldn't it? I mean, you've got to have it for a lot of things, for a lot of things. The discussion last night was about different kinds of roux and then also about bottled and prepared roux, you know. My feeling is that the prepared roux are very good. And from what I've seen, an awful lot of people use them. They're widely, widely used. And for an awful lot of people, they just are looking for ways to cut down the time that they spend cooking. And I think the prepared roux are certainly acceptable. And when people used to have cooks and the cooks cooked every day, and they, for the most part, they didn't make a roux every time they started a dish. They would make up a pot of roux that would be enough to last them for a week or so. And then they would have it ready whenever they were doing the dishes. Restaurant chefs, the same thing. They don't start from scratch and make a roux each time. They make a big pot of roux and have it ready, and then the roux is ready when they use it. Now, I think if you are lucky enough to have a special kind of fat, you know, if you're lucky enough to have some duck fat, or even some bacon grease, you know, you can make something that's different from what you're going to get in the bottle. But if you're going to use some vegetable oil and some flour, I think it's comes out about the same.
Well, let me ask you this. I think people are using more roux in the jar, it seems to me, in Southwest Louisiana than they are over here in the city. And one of the differences that I see in the use of the roux is if you've got that already made roux, you add the roux to the liquid.
Right.
And virtually everything I cook, I add the liquid to the roux.
Right. It does. It changes the order of things that you're doing. And from what I understand, restaurant chefs who make up big batches of roux, they've got the same situation. They're not doing it in the classic traditional way. I mean, I don't think it's a problem. I mean, I think you come out with the same result, but it just involves doing it in a different order. That's interesting what you said about people in Southwest Louisiana using the bottle roux more than they are here. But I think in general, the cooks in Southwest Louisiana tend to use more roux than people in New Orleans use. That's my impression. I don't have anything to back that up. But, you know, some of the gumbos that people make are really, really thick with roux.
What is your favorite dish in the whole book? What's your favorite thing?
Oh, my favorite dish in the whole book? Oh, probably one of the gumbos. Gumbo's one of my favorite dishes, if not my favorite dish of anything, really. Just to see it and smell it cooking is great. I've always found when I'm learning to make something, I don't want to read just one cook's explanation of it. I want to read three or four or five or six, because none of them are going to be the same. They're all going to be different. And you learn so much more by comparing what different people do. If you do that, you can kind of develop your own personal style and approach to it. So that's just the way that I learned. And also, I mean, you continue learning, I think, and watching other people doing it, you pick up things that you didn't know before. You know, even recipes that I've published, when I make them again, even after they've been published, I keep working on them and changing them. And, you know, it's never finished. You're always trying to make it better, right?
That's right.
And that's what makes it so interesting, so much fun.
What's your favorite pot to make a roux in?
A black cast iron skillet, you know. I mean, it's not a family heirloom, but I've had it for a good while. I've had it for a good while, yeah. I remember one guy telling me, he said, sometimes when I'm in a hurry, I'll make my roux in the microwave. He said, but you know, I just don't feel right about it. And I do think that for making a roux, and this is true for a lot of different things, even if you're mostly going to buy the roux in a jar and use that, you still should learn how to do it. And from time to time, it makes sense to do it, because it puts you closer with the ingredients. It's like anything in cooking, I think. I used to be, I mean, when I was younger, I was an absolute purist. I mean, I wouldn't use an electric mixer to whip cream, you know, because I felt like whipped cream was better if you used a whisk. And maybe it is, I don't know, but now I use a mixer. I used to not own any electrical small appliances, you know. I've outgrown some of those things.
What do you think the most challenging thing in cooking Louisiana food is, maybe besides the roux?
Well, that's a good question.
I guess it's not fair because it probably is the roux.
Well, I think getting the flavors right, because, you know, the combination of flavors and the amount of things that you put in there. Because oftentimes, if you get away from Louisiana and you go to restaurants that have Louisiana food, things are just not quite right. Louisiana food got a reputation as being just fiery hot with pepper, and that's what a lot of people think that Louisiana food is, you know. Well, it always comes up, of course, you know, people bring up the question of what's the difference between Cajun and Creole cooking and all of that. Before Paul Prudhomme opened K. Paul's in the late 70s, 79, I think it was around then, you really didn't see Cajun food in New Orleans. To my memory.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And honestly, Paul's food wasn't really Cajun food. It was really a fusion.
Right. It was his own personal style of Cajun cooking. And he does come from Opelousas, where they do use a lot of pepper. So I think some of the distinctions kind of have gotten blurred over the last 30 or 40 years, you know.
I think it's confusion.
I think you're right.
It's the fusion that caused the great confusion.
I think you're right.
Because they're really two different kinds of things, and I think that people should respect that difference. What's the most unusual gumbo you've ever had?
I've judged at the gumbo cook-off in New Iberia for a number of years, and they have different categories. They have one category that is called mélange.
Okay.
You don't know what's in there. They can put anything in it. Then with some of my friends who hunt, I've had some interesting gumbos, you know, with duck and partridge and dove and, you know, all kinds of things in there. There's one gumbo that that I make from time to time. It's the only one that I make that I don't generally eat with rice. And that's a dried shrimp and egg gumbo.
Mm.
But you know what's interesting? Louisiana didn't really become a big rice-producing state until the late 19th century, mm-hmm. when a lot of Midwesterners came down and started out in southwest Louisiana raising rice. Before then, there was rice production in Louisiana, but it was a more occasional kind of thing. Sometimes they called it Providence rice because it depended on the rainfall rather than they weren't irrigating it. Mm-hmm. And there was a travel book written by a man named Robin. I think it was R.R. Robin. I'm not mm-hmm. sure. You're familiar with that? He traveled in Louisiana, I think it was about 1803, 1804, 1805. And he said in the travel book that when he was served gumbo, it wasn't served with rice. It was served with a cornmeal mush.
Now that I didn't know.
And an interesting thing with that, my ear, nose, and throat doctor, he hunts all over the world. And he was on a safari in Africa, I forget which country, and they had shot some small birds. And he taught the camp cooks how to make gumbo. They didn't know anything about gumbo, but he taught them how to make gumbo. They didn't have any rice in the camp, so what did they serve it with? A cornmeal mush. Isn't that interesting?
That's fascinating. How does gumbo get its name?
Well, I'm not sure that we can really say for sure. Don't you think? I mean, gumbo was the word for okra, wasn't it?
Yeah, king gumbo.
King
yeah.
gumbo. Yeah. I don't know. I think there's some other theories on it also.
Well, I wanted to see if you had a theory on it because it's one of my favorite things to say, and we'll never know for sure.
We'll never know
unless we learn how to time travel.
Right.
Author Stanley Dry on roux, rice, and gumbo. Pick up a copy of the Essential Louisiana Cookbook from your local independent bookseller. On Tuesday, November 3rd, our friends at Brady's Wine Warehouse are hosting the next Louisiana Eats and Cooks Club at their amazing store on the corner of Calliope and OCH. We'll be cooking from my new book, The Two Jacks Restaurant Cookbook, revealing recipes and stories from the city's second oldest restaurant. Each dish served will be expertly paired with a wine selection from Brady's amazing collection. You'll find the link for tickets on the Southern Food and Beverage Museum's website at southernfood.org and on our Louisiana Eats website at itsneworleans.com. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we go ghost hunting in the haunted New Orleans French Quarter.
Now, after his death, people will say they've seen him out here in the courtyard walking around. They've seen him in the bar. And occasionally a patron who's sitting at the bar will instruct the bartender to buy that gentleman down there in the corner a drink.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com.
Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by Tableau, Dickie Brennan's latest restaurant serving local Creole cuisine with a view of Jackson Square. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Sean Johnson. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.